I ask this of every lawyer who comes on this show, Dave, and there's no right or wrong answer, but I got to ask, did you like law school?
Yeah, you know, I've heard your stories about law school. I took an opposite approach.
So you have listened to some of my stuff.
Of course, you know, like any good lawyer, I prepare for the meeting. I've read the book, I've listened to the podcast, but I absolutely love law school. Like I said, I struggled a lot.
This is Mike Bassett, and welcome to Legal Grounds, conversations on life, leadership, and law. In the summer of 2016, I had a conversation with one of my older brothers that would end up changing the course of my year. It was an innocuous conversation. My brother, 75 at the time, has pulled his back doing, that's right, CrossFit. A former Army Ranger and the perpetual bachelor, Sterling ran his 5 miles every day and was always trying something new. I gave him hell the way that brothers do, and I told him to look after himself. 2 weeks later, when he finally admitted to me that he couldn't bend over in the shower, he made an appointment at the VA. So it was that my brother, who was in better shape than the rest of our family combined, was diagnosed with an aggressive and almost certainly terminal form of cancer. It had started in his back and was moving rapidly. From there, the story plays out like it does for so many families. At first, it was conventional treatment. Then came the specialists. Then came the specialist's specialist. In the end, my brother decided he would rather spend his last days in the home he'd built for himself, his dream home that overlooked the west side of El Paso and into Juarez. He held on for another 6 weeks, and because I am beyond fortunate, Liz and I were able to spend that time with him. Uninterrupted, and thanks to an amazing team of caregivers, relatively unburdened. But for the purpose of today's episode, one of the things that still stands out to this day has nothing to do with doctors or medication schedules or planning funeral arrangements. Instead, it was that every single attorney I was working a case with cleared the decks without a word of frustration. Now, we talk a lot about the adversarial nature that is inherent in the legal profession. And while it's not nearly as combative as it's portrayed on screen, even in 2016, yours truly worried about possibly having to deal with some jerk lawyer. Instead, my inbox and mailbox overflowed with messages whose words ranged from simple kindness to people sharing truly vulnerable stories of losing their loved ones. Now, I had been practicing law for over 3 decades at that point and was incredibly fortunate to have a well-established support team that allowed me to put my professional responsibilities aside, which is why I heard the story of my guest today, I was awestruck. Dave Obrand had just finished earning his JD when he got the call that his father had stage 4 cancer in his kidneys. Having not even taken the bar, Dave moved back home to be with his father. I'll let Dave tell you the rest of the story during our conversation, but as a small introduction, he attended UCLA and then went on to earn his JD from the University of Arizona James E. Rogers College of Law. After graduating, he worked as an attorney across multiple areas from education, constitutional claims, civil defense litigation, and professional liability defense. Dave currently works for the County of Orange as the Deputy County Counsel. In his spare time, he enjoys spending time with his family, watching the Dodgers play baseball and the Bruins do basically anything. And I couldn't be happier to have him here with me today. Dave Obrand, welcome to Legal Grounds.
Thanks, Mike. I'm really excited to be here. And I got to tell you, that cold open got my heart rate up a little bit because, you know, those memories are still fresh for me.
Yeah, I'm telling you, dude. I look back on it and I tell people it was one of the most honorable and wonderful things I ever got to do. And it was absolutely one of the worst things I ever got to do.
No question.
At the same time, and we'll get to that. So I know from listening to your interview on the Jason and Kelsey podcast that your dad played a huge role in your life. So to start, can you share with us who your dad was and what he meant to the community, Dave?
Yeah, so, you know, before my dad got to teaching, at about the age of 8 years old, my dad started researching sports. And he actually made a name for himself back in high school as this prolific mind of knowledge relating to high school sports, where people went to high school. And he developed that into a whole career of sports research. But of course, his main professional passion was teaching. He was a teacher in Los Angeles Unified School District for 39 years. 37 of those, I think, were at the same school. And, you know, he was my father, my brother's father. But he was the father figure to a lot of kids that he taught, kids that came from tough backgrounds, walking people down the aisle. And one story we'll probably get into, I think probably towards the end of this interview. You know, my uncle Rudy, my dad's brother-in-law, is actually a former student of his. And the way my mom and dad met was they both attended my Uncle Rudy and my Tia Nancy, my mom's sister's wedding. And they were introduced there. And thank God for that, because I wouldn't be here otherwise.
That's a great story. I want to unpack that just a little bit. You threw out some numbers that I think are really impressive, and they just rolled off your tongue without much effort. 39 years as a teacher, 37 at the same school. Dude, that is some consistency, and that is just showing up to work every day. How does that manifest itself in your life, Dave?
You know, the main thing my dad always taught me was, you know, do your best. You don't have to be the best at everything, but you always have to do your best. And the only way to do your best is that consistent show up every single day, grind, work, and always be striving to improve. My dad loved the challenge of teaching because subject matter didn't really change year to year, but there was always a new set of students and a challenge to improve, be better, be the best he could for his students. I got to see that firsthand. He would bring me into the classroom pretty often, and it was just a great childhood watching him work.
So I'm assuming if your family is like mine, we kind of gave each other grief a lot and still do. Did it kind of become a joke when your dad was out and he would run into a former student? Was there just like a, everybody rolled the eyes around the table and like, here's dad's former student. Of course, you know, my dad, of course he taught you. Did that happen a lot, Dave?
I'll tell you, the really crazy thing is, yes, that happened all the time. But the really crazy thing is I look a lot like my dad. I sound a lot like my dad. I would go to Costco and I'd be checking out. Someone would see the card, see my face and say, are you Rick O'Brien's son or are you Mr. O'Brien's son? And then it would turn into a 15-minute conversation holding up the line because they had to tell me how great dad was.
And you know what? That has really got to feel good and on just a whole lot of levels.
Yeah. You know, it's another thing I wrote about in his eulogy, actually, was when I was a kid, I would be jealous of a lot of students because this was my dad. And who are all these other people taking a claim of him? But as I got older, I realized I was really the lucky one because I got him all the time. Anytime I called him, he was there. And it was really encouraging for me to see what someone could do on what so many people would consider a small stage and the impact that he could make because he cared so much.
When you think about it, let's just say, I mean, 30 students to a class and it's taught six classes a day, that's 180 students. But you multiply that over 37 or 39 years, Dave, you're starting to talk some big numbers.
No question. It's you know, it got to a point where my wife would make fun of me because when I first moved back to LA, we would be out in the South Bay where I grew up and people would recognize me, like I said. And I had a bit of my dad's gregarious personality. And, you know, the network that he had was enormous. The people he knew in different areas of the world was incredible. He was an incredibly well-rounded person. And a lot of that was because he loved people. He listened to them and cared about them. And so people wanted to keep him in his life.
And while I don't want to spend all of our time today on this, let's call it the challenging portion of your life. You spent a decade waiting for the other shoe to drop. And something you said in that interview with Jason and Kelsey caught me, which was this: When you wait for so long for someone to pass away, you start to think maybe you'll never lose them. What do you think that lesson, specifically about the value of time, taught you about relationships, Dave, both in your personal and your professional life?
You know, Mike, that's a great question, not one I think I've specifically thought about. I do think being the son of Rick Obrand, I had that lesson ingrained in me pretty well. You know, he was a historian. He looked at these historical figures and taught me all about them. And that showed me the importance of having that generative drive to get things done, to work hard with the time that you had, to spend time with family. I learned to be a family man from my dad, who took on more than just his family. And it is precious time, and you must always make the most of it. And that's not always working, but that's always being appreciative of the time that you have and avoiding the waste that comes with worry, with trying to achieve things that aren't the important thing. You know, a Stoic will say, make the main thing the main thing.
There you go.
Keep your eyes on that main thing and avoid the waste that comes when you're not doing that.
And we're going to backpedal a bit, and I want to visit a little bit about your early life. And while I know your dad obviously takes one of the top spots, Dave, who were some of those early mentors or coaches? Because I know you played some rugby and football in college. And who were some of those folks? And most importantly, what are some of the lessons that you learned from them that you still carry today?
You know, first, I do have to do a quick shout out to Mom. My mom was an immigrant. She was an immigrant from Nicaragua that came here with nothing, the classic immigrant story. She and her older sister supported a family of seven, just the two of them, working odd jobs. She turned that work ethic into a 30-year career in the insurance business. She's still working full-time now. I think I owe a lot of my work ethic to her.
Wow.
My high school football coach, Rock Hollis, he taught me the idea of competitive greatness, something you learn from John Wooden. Winning wasn't necessarily the end goal, but it was being the best you could be out on the football field. When I was in high school, I started both ways. I played about 45 minutes out of 48-minute football games, and I was dead after a game, but I loved it because everything I had was on that football field. And lastly, I was a kid. You probably have seen a little bit of this from my background. I was diagnosed with ADHD recently, something I've had throughout my life. Wasn't always a great student. I went to junior college. I had two English professors, Deborah Breckheimer and Lyman Hong. Both of them were willing to sit with me and teach me how to write, how to get my thoughts across, and gave me a lot of confidence as a student. So when I got to a place like UCLA, which I thought wasn't a place I could go to and be successful, I was successful, got to law school, succeeded there, and it's carried me through my legal career.
And you look back and those kudos to people flow so easily off your tongue, which leads me to believe you've thought about them before, which is great. Have you ever thought of the impact that you have already had on the people around you, Dave, and never even known it? Do you ever think about that every once in a while?
I don't. But, you know, I do write a lot. And part of why I write, especially I've taken up writing children's stories more recently. Part of why I write, especially those children's stories, those are the messages I want to get across to my daughter. Sometimes it's a conversation I have with her, and it's a spark for a story. Sometimes it's something I see in the news, and I know it's a difficult subject that I'm going to want to have a conversation with her about. I know I've done good things for other people. I've seen the response from that in my current campaign. People willing to go out of their way to help me has been pretty incredible. And I know that's largely due to the fact that I've done that same thing for others, but it's not something I've particularly thought about.
And so folks, when they get on the podcast and we'll go to your, we're going to drop some websites and links in the show notes so folks can go look you up. If I called down to Central Casting and said, send me an author that looks like he writes children's books, it would not be somebody big like you. Okay, you're like the guy, send me the linebacker that's going to scare people. Let's talk about these children's books. And you mentioned something earlier that kind of caught my mind. You say, I'm using these books and these stories to maybe address things that are in the news and be able to convey them. Can you give us an example of a story maybe that you've written recently or one that stands out to you of what you're trying to convey and do with these stories, Dave?
Sure. There's one easily that comes to mind. Shortly after the murder of George Floyd, I wrote a story called We All Must Be Activists. And the story starts with a father and his daughter shooting some hoops in the front yard. And dad's upset because the news is bogging him down. And his daughter asks him what's wrong and cheers him up. And then he goes through this story of all these great activists throughout the world. But it ends with, today, you were my activist. You brought my mood up. You were there for me when I needed it. And we all have that power to be an activist in some capacity, big or small.
That's a great story. And, you know, that's a message that's resonated through time. How many times have we heard about, I mean, I'm Catholic by faith. You hear about the saints doing just little things with greatness. You don't have to do great things, like you said, on a great stage, but you can really make an impact on the small stage. That's a neat story. I think I ask this of every lawyer who comes on this show, Dave, and there's no right or wrong answer, but I got to ask, did you like law school?
Yeah, you know, I've heard your stories about law school. I took an opposite approach.
So you have listened to some of my stuff.
Of course. You know, like any good lawyer, I prepare for the meeting. I've read the book. I've listened to the podcast, but I absolutely loved law school. Like I said, I struggled a lot in school.
Yeah.
But the great thing about law, for me, it is history. So when I'm reading a case, I'm placing the people and characters in that story and the historical significance later on. That's what precedence is. So the subject matter was interesting. The people I went to law school with were great. I did a long time of figuring out where I wanted to go to law school. And I picked Arizona based on a lot of different factors. And it was the right choice for me. And that's something I'm really grateful for. Struggling to fit in my life has helped me figure out who I am. And I'm able to make those decisions that kind of lead me to the right place.
And full disclosure, I'm glad you got to go to the place you wanted. I got to go to the one place I was accepted, just for the record. Okay. So, and the second question I have is this. So go back and you're talking to L1, Dave. First year law student, first, second week of school. You go back and sit down and talk to him. What do you tell him now that you're this far out from graduating and being a practicing lawyer?
Don't make your plans too concrete because they are going to change. I was, fast forward to 3L year, I was working with a law firm, had a job lined up. I was interviewing with a bankruptcy judge. I thought my life was in Arizona. And sure enough, I get that call, spring break, my dad's sick, everything changed. So be flexible. Don't think you know everything. Be able to adapt to the circumstances around you.
That's some great advice. Now, you ended up externing for a U.S. district judge in your final year of law school. And I know that when I did my clerkship, I'm not sure I realized how lucky I was to see things from the inside. What was your experience with that, Dave?
I got to say, Judge Cindy Jorgensen was a great mentor. I don't know if she remembers me, but she was the type of...
We're going to say she does.
She was the type of person that was going to sit down with me and go through the cases and tell me her thought process and make sure I got something out of that. Seeing the work that goes into those cases to ensure that the law is applied correctly and with justice, is something that I took away from that and made me optimistic about the law. I think it's really easy to look at how lawyers and the law are portrayed in the media and otherwise, and be pessimistic, but there's reason to be optimistic about the law.
Yeah, well, I can tell you, I want to talk with you a little bit about your time in private practice before we jump to your current job as the deputy county counsel. One question about the externship. Do you think that influenced your decision at all to go into public service, or had that seed been planted earlier, Dave?
Yeah, I always wanted to work in my community. You know, growing up the son of a teacher, I thought I was going to be a teacher or a coach, something like that my whole life. So I always had the goal of being some sort of public entity, attorney, or working for the greater good of my community. But I will say, Judge Jorgensen, the way that she, you know, could have taken on other jobs, made a lot more money, but was so dedicated to the law and doing good, remained in her seat. That was admirable and something I looked up to.
I want to go back and just unpack this term you used a little bit earlier, work ethic, and you also used the word grind. And this job as a lawyer is a hard, hard job. It is a lot of work. It sounds to me like your DNA from how you were raised taught you that that was just a fact, and one just accepted that things were tough or you had to work hard to get what you wanted. Fair assessment?
Definitely.
And my next question is this. Can we teach others and can we show others what a work ethic looks like? And most importantly, why I think it is the calling card for people of impact.
I certainly think work ethic is something that can be taught and developed. I think we all have a capacity to be better, to work harder. What people need to understand and be shown sometimes is what are the fruits of that labor? Because I think too often we're told to follow a certain path and things will just work out. And that's just not the truth. Mm-hmm. You have to find the path that fits you. And then you've got to give everything you've got to that to make things work out. And too often people are told to follow this path, things will work out, and they don't. And that's reason enough to not do it again, to not work hard. Right. So showing people that there's opportunities out there, just keep working. You're going to find them and then try to learn yourself so you can figure out the best path for you.
I think a lot of attorneys spend their first couple of years in their career figuring out what kind of law they don't want to practice. And that's not a bad thing. You know, for me, it was medical malpractice. I think you would have more luck teaching a dog to juggle. So what were your early years of practice like, Dave? That's my first question in this subpart.
You know, Mike, I think you and I have a lot in common, but we do disagree on some things. I started off in med mal also. I loved it again. I loved learning the medicine.
Sure.
I love the opportunity to grow my knowledge base on medicine. It's something I've always been kind of interested in, so I had a head start that way. But I remember 2 weeks into my first job being told I was going to take a deposition. Never sat in a deposition before.
What is this deposition thing of which you speak?
Exactly. So I spent about 3 days poring over records, devising a question sheet, probably 30 pages long, revising it, going back and forth, killed myself, did terrible at that deposition. But I learned more from doing that deposition than I did probably in the first year overall of being a lawyer. And what I learned is you're not going to know everything before you do it. You just got to do it. Again, put your best effort forward, absorb what you can. And that trial by fire made me a more successful attorney.
You know, I've often thought I may have never done something before, but if I go and do it, at least I've done it. At least I've tried. And you know what? Now I've done X, and the next time I'll be better. Generally can't get worse, but certainly can do better.
That's true.
When you started in practice, what were some of the challenges you faced? I mean, was it the billable hour requirement? Was it, I don't know, draconian rules? What were some of the things you as a young lawyer faced in your career?
You know, despite being a competitor most of my life playing competitive sports, I don't see myself as too much of an adversarial character. I like to get along with people. I like to be a consensus builder. And so some of those early, really contentious hearings, depositions, just meet and confer moments I had with attorneys were difficult for me. And building up that ability to be stern and professional, not let my emotions get the best of me. It's something I definitely had within me, but it was a skill I really had to develop. That first deposition was a good example where I got kind of railroaded by a more senior attorney who took advantage of the new pup. And it taught me a lot to stick up for myself, and that wasn't going to happen to me again.
Yeah, and we do learn. We learn more from our mistakes, and we grow in the hard times. I mean, I don't think anybody that's ever just had smooth sailing that said, you know what, that was really a fruitful time in my life. I really grew. I don't think that happens.
You know, the adversity definitely builds growth. It's the idea of, you know, training, right? You don't train the things you're good at. You train the things that you struggle with. And that's what makes you better. And that's, again, something I was fortunate. Besides my dad being a great teacher, his love of sports, coaching me up in all the sports that I did, making me run despite being a big guy, teaching me footwork, which made me a much better ball player. The things I didn't want to necessarily do were the things that made me a better football player, better athlete overall.
Yeah, I mean, the more we sweat in training, the less we bleed in battle.
Yeah.
So you're a young lawyer. Tell me about a mentor that you had, or maybe someone that made a positive impact in your life that maybe never even knew it in those first couple of years of practice, Dave.
You know, I don't know if this was, well, I do have my very first job. There was a guy, Jason Argos. He went to Arizona for undergrad, so we had that connection. We were about the same age, but he went straight from college to law school, so he had a couple years on me, and he took me under his wing.
Which, as a young lawyer, is like an eternity, am I right?
Oh, yeah.
He's been there 2 years. They're like the old guy.
When we're 28 and he has 2 years of experience, he was an old vet for sure, and taught me a lot, not just the practice of law. You know, he was always there to give me sample documents to work from, but also how to manage myself in different settings. Learning the business, like you said, billable hours were difficult, something I definitely had trouble with, just accounting for everything. And it really took me under his wing. And then a little later on, I worked under a partner at a place called Fagan Friedman and Fulfrost named Lynn Beekman. And just the unbelievable work ethic that she had, but also the humility and the fact that if we were working on a motion at 9 p.m., I wasn't there emailing her waiting for a response tomorrow morning. She was working right next to me. And to me, that's a great leader. Someone who doesn't say, do this for me. Someone that says, let's do this.
You know, it's funny you said that. I often come back from CLEs because I speak and I'll listen. And I will come back and say, man, there were some smart people at that CLE. And I am continually amazed at how many really smart lawyers there are out there, Dave. I mean, subject matter experts, I'm just blown away.
It's pretty incredible. It can be intimidating, especially for someone like me that did struggle in school a lot. But again, that work ethic, you know, I know that I can get there. I don't see knowledge as some finite ability that we have. The thing that I get to know before anyone else does, you're not going to outwork me. And that's a huge advantage to have.
You know, when you were starting that sentence, I was going to say, my office looks down towards downtown Dallas, and I get in early. I try to be here before 6 a.m. And most mornings I look out there to downtown and say, I'm outworking you guys today. A lot of people smarter in Dallas than me. Lord Almighty, there's a bunch. But just knowing, if you want to outwork me, you better get up early.
You know, Mike, if I could just tell you one great story that I love. And
please.
It sounds like I have a chip on my shoulder, but I don't think that's what it is. But when I was in Arizona for law school, one of my very best friends since I was about 6 years old, his then fiance was in optometry school out there. And so we all met up for lunch, and she's saying, or he's introducing me to her, and he says, you know, if you would have told me Dave was going to go to UCLA and then law school, I would have never believed you. And he wasn't wrong. If you knew me in high school, those things weren't on the table. But it was the fact that I was able to apply myself, take the same work ethic I had to go from an undersized offensive lineman and get on the cusp of playing Division I football, apply that to school. It got me there. And it's carried me again through my legal career.
That is an absolute compliment. Only as a best friend or a good friend would tell you, but that's a compliment. So I'm going to flip the question, and I do not want you to name names, but I believe that sometimes we learn our best lessons from dealing with people that are very difficult and that sometimes make our life difficult. So was there any moment in your early years of practice, Dave, where like, you know what? I'm never doing that. That I will never do. This, that is not the way to do things. Did you have those moments, Dave? Because I did.
It happens continually, Mike. You know this as a lawyer. I think the ultimate sign of respect and the easiest way to get me to respect you and want to work with you is to show up prepared. And attorneys that show up, they don't know the facts. They don't even know who their client is. They don't know who I am. I lose all respect, and I was never going to be that person. I'm always prepared. And the same way I know you prepare for this podcast, I wasn't going to show up unprepared. It's just a sign of respect. And I think that's a huge thing in the law practice. It's a huge thing in life.
You know, it's funny you say that. We have had this conversation on and on and on in my life, in my married life, in my professional life. You know, I'm a product of a military household. And time is everything. And in defense of my old man and my brothers who saw wartime, the difference of a minute can mean the difference of a life. Now, in real life, not so much. I mean, you're a minute late. They may close the door of an airplane on you, but no one's losing their life. And so I have come to believe, because I was taught, when you are late, you're sending a message of, I do not respect you or your time. Now, we've had this conversation of maybe just people are late and it's not about you. But you talk about this thing of respect. I think that that is probably, like you said, the greatest tribute that we as lawyers get is when someone hires us, right, to represent them or a family member or someone refers us business. Your thoughts on that?
No question. You know, I think I have made myself known among my friends and family as the lawyer they'll go to with their general legal questions. And I certainly don't have all the answers. I think that's some of the difficulty of being a lawyer, getting questions you don't know the answer to. But I'm certainly going to try to help. And I appreciate it that they think of me as someone who's knowledgeable or at least willing to help and be prepared and do that work.
One of the things that brings me the most pleasure is when people call me and say, listen, I have this deal. Could you know somebody? They never expect me to do it because they know my limitations. But when you can connect somebody with somebody that can help them, that always makes me feel really good because I think, you know what, this network I've been fortunate enough to build, it has benefited somebody else.
Certainly. I've certainly referred my friends out for personal injuries and things like that. I did have a situation, close friend was wounded in a mass shooting once. And without question, after we got through the conversations of dealing with the aftermath of that, I said to her, let me know when you want me to see what I can do for you as far as figuring out the legal aspects. We stayed in touch. I helped her navigate certain parts of the legal aspects of that. Obviously, I didn't represent her. That's not my area. But it only made us closer. And it's actually my wife's friend. But it's the one friend of my wife's that is actually my friend also. We will text individually. And being able to be a counselor, which is what attorneys are, even if I'm not representing someone directly, is something I take very seriously and an opportunity I really appreciate.
So, you know, this next section I'm going to talk about public service and handling certain types of cases, but I want to start with a story. I remember when I was adopted, when I was 9 years old, and I remember going to the hearing, and I remember the judge saying, I love these types of hearings in court because I do things that make people happy. And so I know you handled cases in dependency court where you're working with issues where there may be child services, CPS here in Texas. I don't know what the name is out there in California. And I know from some of the briefing material and the stuff that I was given that I read that one of the things you, Dave, find their most rewarding is the opportunity to reunite families instead of take them apart. And I don't want to portray anybody's anonymity, but is there one or maybe even more, a couple of cases that stand out in your mind, Dave, where you went home and thought, you know, I did good work today?
You know, it's interesting that you bring up the story of your own adoption, because when we would have adoptions in the courtroom, unfortunately, they weren't particularly common, but it was a celebration.
Yeah, buddy.
Cleared the courtroom, but for however many family members you wanted to bring in, we took pictures. People were allowed to approach the bench, which is not allowed under any other circumstance. Kids received gifts. It was a celebration every time, and it was the time that we really felt like this is the work we're doing. This isn't getting through cases. This is why we're here. The other instances, like you said, and I am going to speak broadly because I do want to protect anonymity as much as possible, but the other great work we did was, man, when we got to reunify a kid with her mom or both parents or a grandparent, and that relief, the family finally felt like they had gotten through. I mean, I know you've gone through some trials. Of course, I've gone through some trials. Nothing can be worse than feeling like you've lost your family.
Mm-hmm.
And the great work we're able to do, the reason why we're there is to provide substance abuse services, therapy services. Sometimes it's keeping everyone away for a while so that they can just work
cool
on
down.
Themselves.
Yeah.
And we got to see those services work. My biggest issue, we just don't have enough of those resources, and we need to improve that.
You know, I'll agree with you 100%. And there are, and my work that I do is not near as emotionally charged as yours. And even in my work, in learning people's lives, because I get to know people, and let's face it, I see people at not their best moments. No case ends up on my desk where everybody's having a great day. It just doesn't happen. And if I had a dollar for every time I went home and told my wife, I am so thankful for our boring, simple life. Free of chaos, self-inflicted or otherwise. Free of drama, self-inflicted or otherwise. And do you ever have those conversations with your wife where you're like, you know what? I just want to sit at home and watch a movie, period, full stop.
You know, my daughter's 5, and one thing we've really started to focus on is dinner.
Yeah.
We sit at the dinner table. We've got 30 minutes or so where we're just eating, talking, and our dinner table faces out to our backyard, and we've got a nice patch of grass. Right now it's raining here in Southern California, and we just look out and say, we can't get any better than this. Mm-hmm. This is all I ever wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And that appreciation of what you have, nothing else that I want. We say that all the time. There's nothing else I really want right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that was instilled in me as a kid. You know, my dad taught me, he would take my brother and I to Skid Row sometimes and show us how tough it is for people to live in certain areas. He would tell us the stories of his own struggles growing up in poverty as a kid. So I've always had that appreciation. I was one of those people. I think one of the reasons why I loved law school, I just appreciated being in law school for 3 years. Like, I was going to make the most of it.
Sure.
But right now we have a beautiful, healthy little girl who's doing great in school. My wife's got a great job that she's had for the last decade. I'm in the job that I strive for, and I worked really hard to get here, and it took me a lot to get here, which is the story of my life.
Sure.
And we're just appreciative of what we have.
Free parenting advice. My sons are 37 and 36. That sitting around the table and breaking bread will pay dividends. Now, maybe when she's a teenager, not so much, but as they get older. And focusing on memories and events rather than things. Some of the best time we ever spent was on vacations with our kids as a gift, because we can still laugh about those. They don't remember what they got for Christmas when they were 12. They don't. but they do remember the trip to Boston and when this happened. So yeah. Free parenting advice worth what you paid for today, which was nothing.
Hey, I appreciate it. I'm always open to take the advice from those who have done it before me.
So this is going to be a little off topic, but when I went to poke around the website for Orange County out of curiosity, I noticed there were not one, not two, but five language options. So needless to say, it's a fairly diverse county in an already diverse state. And you alluded to this earlier, and your parents were worlds apart as people can imagine culturally. So the story I tell myself is that you've seen a lot of different ways of living. How has that impacted your legal career and how you view people, Dave?
Yeah, you know, as a lawyer, as you mentioned, most people talking to their lawyer are there on their worst day of their life or among them.
Yeah.
And being able to take people as they are, not judge them for what they've done or who they are, is something that comes naturally to me. But I think more importantly, growing up in that household, not just mixed race, my mom's Nicaraguan, my dad's a white guy from LA. But you know, my mom's also a very devout evangelical. My dad's Jewish and I was raised Jewish. Right. So having that ability to accept the differences, find the common ground, and appreciate the lessons that come from all those has been something that has really helped me throughout my life. It makes me open to new experiences, new people, and I just appreciate learning from people around me.
And as we wrap up, I would be remiss not to ask you about your entering the race for the California State Assembly. Now, we've never had a candidate for office on this podcast, and I do want listeners to know that while Legal Grounds is apolitical, we value giving everybody a chance to share their goals and ideas of how to make their community better. So with that aside, tell us why you decided to run and what are some of the things you're hoping to change, Dave?
Sure. You know, I received some emails from our current assembly member who I think is a good person trying to do what he thinks is right. But I found certain parts of that email to be a bit misleading. And I think one thing that frustrates me and basically everybody else who watches politics is inconsistency and the the lack of practice of honoring principles. And I want to do this race in an honest way with integrity and following my principles. And the leading principle that I follow is, you know, my dad used to start every class with, we're going to use the F word in this class. And the F word for him was fair. And as a kid who grew up now knowing that I had ADHD, as a kid who grew up with a mom from a different country, as a kid who grew up going to a school district outside of my home school district and a little bit less affluent than all of my friends, I saw sometimes how things weren't quite fair for me. And I had a lot of great advantages that helped me get to where I am. And those opportunities need to be there for everyone. And so more than anything, I want to make sure that I'm creating policies that give people fair opportunities to succeed, that give my daughter a clean, safe place to live in the future, and bring value to our community, improve our schools. Housing out here in California is notoriously difficult. Mm-hmm. Make sure that people aren't living on the streets. Bringing those services that reunited families in dependency. But fairness is the thing that I'm preaching. Equity is probably the term that comes out the most. And that's what I'm trying to achieve.
What is the biggest challenge facing your community that you think folks are not talking about, Dave?
I will say, again, kind of going back to my point of entering this race, it's leaders with a clear picture of their own principles and those that are unwilling to violate those principles. Leaders that have integrity. Far too often, because of what you have to go through to achieve those leadership positions, people are willing to sacrifice their own principles. And so ensuring that we have good leadership, ensuring that we have good transparency of our leadership, that's the biggest issue. And a lot of the rhetoric that we see, because when I talk to people that disagree with me on certain policies, we don't disagree on what our overall values of life are. Mm-hmm. But having leaders that are willing to give in to dangerous rhetoric or incorrect statements in order to achieve a certain position, that's the biggest problem we're facing.
We are going to drop in the show notes a link to your website for your campaign. If folks are interested in reaching out to you, other than that, is there any way else, any other way they can reach you, Dave?
On the website, we do have an email address. I answer those emails myself personally, so feel free to shoot me an email. You can also find me on Facebook, Dave Obrand for Assembly. On Instagram, I'm Dave Obrand. I also have another Instagram page that I run. It's dedicated to my dad. He had this amazing sports collection, and I tell a lot of the stories he told me, and I think it's really cool. It's not something I get to do as much as I want to right now because of the campaign, but if you're at all interested in sports memorabilia or just really great, historically significant sports stories, check out Rick's_picks_1946, the year. That's the year he was born. That's a fun one to follow.
You know what? We'll drop all those in the show notes. And I can do this because you're a lawyer. In 60 seconds, make the case for young lawyers listening out there to consider a career in public service, Dave.
Listen, you know, as a lawyer, we are counselors, and our job is to assist people in difficult times. And the nature of our job makes us leaders, at the very least, in the cases that we handle. And those skills that you develop to interrogate facts, to develop a narrative, tell a story, and be convincing are all characteristics that make for good leaders. Just so long as you honor those principles that you have, be honest, understand yourself, and do it for the right reasons.
Dave Obrand, thank you so much for being on Legal Grounds. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Thanks, Mike. I had a great time, and look forward to continuing listening to the podcast.
This is Mike Bassett for Legal Grounds. Be easy, everybody.
Legal Grounds was written, recorded, and produced by Dust Devil Press. To learn more about today's guest and for links to the topics and materials discussed, please check out our show notes. For more information on Mike Bassett, visit thebassettfirm.com. Questions, topic ideas, and guest suggestions can be emailed to legalgrounds@thebassettfirm.com.